Margetmeyer is a professor of comparative and North American politics, and she is a senior fellow at the Center for Metropolitan Studies in Berlin. Since decades, she has been working on urban and social politics as well as social movements, and we are very excited that she joins us for a conversation. In this podcast, as well as in our research, we are interested in the meaning of political organizing in cities and neighborhoods. Therefore, we started our conversation with Margit with the rather simple question, what are urban movements? Margit, who has been researching the topic for decades, showed us how this question is linked to many others that point to different perspectives on the topic. So in the following talk, I find it exciting that Margit does not only go into the classic but rather narrow definition of Manuel Castells, she rather distinguishes two basic dimensions, that of the city as a site of political organizing and that of the city as an object or target of this organizing. Margit's mapping of various approaches to the subject is also beneficial for anyone wanting to delve deeper. But listen for yourself.
What are urban movements? Or what makes movements urban? Are social movements urban because they take place in cities? Or because they relate to urban issues? Does it matter whether they raise only urban or local issues or thematize urban problems within a larger social context and thereby politicize them? Or does the urban as such, under contemporary conditions, manifest a strategically important position which gives urban movements a larger than just local or just particular relevance? These are the types of questions related to the very simple question that you pose, what is an urban social movement, in my mind anyways. So the original definition that is usually invoked is Castells, Manuel Castells' definition of urban social movements, which he pulls out of his analysis of the 60s and 70s urban movements that he was observing, i.e. at a point in time when Fordism in many places of the world was still intact or entering its crisis point. So in that constellation, he identified three features which to him defined an urban social movement. One, that it was around collective consumption, i.e. crisis of Fordism, the institutions of collective consumption were beginning to, were the quality of it was contested, and people were demanding better collective collective consumption and reproductive institutions, but at least, as opposed to today, they still had them. Now the big demand is, as you all know, about the commons and remunicipalization and deprivatization. So we've come like a long way since then. Anyways, that was his first criterion. The second one was the defense of particular neighborhoods. And the third one was that they participate in the decision-making over their local affairs. The latter point is still, of course, one of the main demands of local and urban movements. And so is the second one, because, I mean, this is also what you're looking at. All phases of neoliberalization have included threats and attacks on not just urban neighborhoods, but as Claire Colomb and Paola Priata point out in the Territory article, also outside of the urban areas where the big infrastructure developments or other threats to people's places of living are are undergoing negative changes. But in the end, what I'm trying to say, this definition of Castells is connected to a peculiar point in time. It's historically specific. And so I would suggest a different, a broader and less historically specific definition for what are urban social movements. And what scholars have done here is falls along two different dimensions. The first dimension would be where they look at cities functioning as sites or the ground where social movements take place, to be distinguished from where the city functions as prize or as the goal or the object of what the social movement is about, right? So in the first, the city is merely a passive site, a place of where a movement appears, a stage where maybe deeper political struggles over the environment, over women's rights, over peace, whatever, are expressed, but they don't really have to do with the city as such, whereas in the other, in the opposite definition, it is the city itself which is the contested object of movements that seek, for example, a more just, a more democratic, or a more sustainable city. That's where many writings over the right to the city would locate themselves. Now, the second dimension is the distinction between those perspectives that highlight particular features and characteristics of cities, such as specific urban infrastructures or cities' relevant or growing role within larger scalar works of the political economy. Like specific urban infrastructures would be large public plazas or proximity that things are dense and nearby and that kind of stuff. But either one are said to make cities particularly conducive to citizen engagement and to activism. And by implication, may then attribute to those movements more political relevance or more democratic or emancipatory potential. If it's true that cities have gained in such relevance, then the movements taking place there and being around the city would also gain a significance that wasn't there before, to be distinguished from perspectives that frame urban social movements as restricted to local or merely spatial aspects, and thus being necessarily particularistic, narrow, and limited, which people have defined as a local trap, that movements who only have this framework get stuck in a local trap and have no potential to get beyond that. So within these dimensions, you have different disciplinary approaches, and they again entail different conceptions of the role of the urban in the context of contemporary conflict and change, to the extent that urbanity is even acknowledged as playing a role. So just to give you a sense, there's social movement theories. They at least initially do not see the urban as a condition that impacts or transforms the practice of political contestation, because political scientists or sociologists, movement researchers have usually been more concerned with the relationships between or the conflicts between social movements and state institutions, and they didn't look at or care about whether this happened within cities or in the countryside. Whereas geographers and urbanists have been at the forefront of discussions on the emancipatory city and the right to the city, and they cover a spectrum of conceptions of the role of the urban in the context of social change. Hence, look at urban social movements as an important category. Some authors that you have probably come across, because they dealt with migrant rights, was Walter Nichols and Justus Uitermark. They make the point that cities, due to their density, their diversity, and the intensity of interactions, are a generative space of mobilizations, incubating and connecting various movements. That to them means they breed, they literally breed contention, but therefore also control. And in order to capture this strategic significance of the urban, which transcends the particular and the narrow focus of the local, they suggest a relational approach to the study of this relationship. I've also looked at David Harvey and Andy Merrifield as geographers with seemingly opposite poles in these debates, because David Harvey has argued that right to the city movements are central for social transformation, that cities are more than the geographic or political targets of movements, at least in this day and age. Whereas Andy Merrifield questioned his city-focused, or questions the city-focused demands of movements as unsuitable for contemporary struggles. And he has concluded that right to the city is not the right that needs articulating. Aside from these geographers, you have in political science some novel developments that have transcended conventional municipal politics that were not interested in urban social movements at all. But these new developments, primarily within French scholarship on political action, has sought to go beyond those confines of urban political science and has highlighted formerly invisible forms of urban contestation. So when Occupy movements or Assemblea movements sprang up in cities from Spain to the US and everywhere else, also in the Middle East, a strand of political theory had a revival that harks back to Aristotle and his ideal polis, and was further developed by Hannah Arendt and others, who zeroed in on these movements' demands for real democracy now. So those, again, are two different novel approaches to look at urban social movements in this day and age that come out of political science. Now, I could go into more detail on each of these, but maybe if you want, I could spell that. In particular, I'm thinking David Harvey's elaboration, which includes a redefinition of the working class, based, of course, on his complex analysis what happens in cities in this day and age, allows him to redefine the working class as people affected not just by the production process, but people also exploited by finance capital, by landlords, and other actors in these circuits of capital. And that might be interesting for your social fields, all of which fall into his newly defined categories of revolutionary subjects, if you want. So that just as a little hint. But basically, I've tried to lay this maybe confusing map of urban social movement definitions out for you, even though you might find some less relevant for your productive definition of urban social movements. But still, you may want to know where you are located, and either favor the descriptive ones that derive either from traditional definitions of the city. By traditional, I here mean pre-planetary urbanization talk. I mean, when city really still had these boundaries and didn't cover the planet as it does since Christian Schmid's and Neil Brenner's work, building on Lefebvre, of course. So traditional definitions of city as marked by density, diversity, intensity, and the frequency of interactions, or other descriptive categories from post-structural conceptualizations of urban spaces as providing, for example, unexpected liminal places for urban contestations to take place. They might be useful in a different way to you than normative ones, which derive either from the ideal polis of citizens or that flow from neo-Marxist interpretations of the urban as causing, producing, or accelerating as active ingredients in the crisis of neoliberal capital. The latter might help shed light on the potential agency of the groups and organizations that you study, as I just alluded to with Harvey's work, where care workers, migrant workers, and tenants occupy crucial positions in his redefined working class. And the concept of encounter suggested by Merrifield against Harvey, which tries to synthesize some of these different definitions to bring them to bear on contemporary urban movements might also be fruitful. But just seeing how loaded and contested these contributions to the debate over such a simple question, what defines urban social movements, are, should, I hope, inspire you to come up with your own contribution.
So that was the first part of Margaret's speech. In the conversation that followed with members of our research project, we touched on a few different points that I will quickly summarize for you. First, we had a discussion about the term local trap and what it means for analyzing urban movements and their political practices. We also talked about how focusing solely on urban movements can create an urban bias in social movement research and neglect rural political initiatives. Moreover, we had a rather controversial debate about defining urban movements regarding Margaret's distinction of the two dimensions, the city as a site of political organizing and the city as a target of political organizing. For example, we discussed whether a political mobilization against deportations in urban spaces can be considered an urban movement, even if it doesn't directly aim to transform the city. There are many other related questions that we would love to discuss with you, our dear listeners, when we have the chance. But now let's move on to the second part of today's episode of our podcast Europe from Below. We've got another short excerpt from our conversation with Margaret coming up. So we've talked about urban movements, but now let's dive into a closely related question. What is the role of municipalities and the local state?
Cities or their local governments have to be seen as part of the larger scalar structure of multi-level governance. And they have also been described as taken on more relevance and more political power at the cost of supra-local scales, regions, and national. In fact, there has been this narrative shift that I'm sure you too have observed, and Hilary Angelo and David Wachsmuth in an article titled, Why Does Everyone Think Cities Can Save the Planet? Put their finger on this expectation that is now virulent, not only in the sustainability field, but in virtually every policy area. Cities are now looked at as the actor that now appears to be in the best position to come up with solutions to all kinds of global crises. And your project also assumes that the local scale or cities create, I quote, new promising approaches with regard to creating cohesion and cross-border cooperation. Now let that sit on your tongue for a while. We are now in the era of neoliberal erosion of cohesion on a grand scale, right? Societies across the globe are exhibiting more and more inequality, and all the politicians say, fine, let cities do some work and create cohesion. We can't do it anymore, but maybe on the local level, they can. And cross-border cooperation at a time when nation states are emphasizing and building and rebuilding walls like never before. All I'm trying to say is this is a very tall order and you should be aware of it. But at the same time, it's of course true that in all of your social fields, cities as the last instance of government find, I mean, they have taken on new roles, and in many aspects, they have created pragmatic or at least better functioning solutions to the problems that we are trying to address. But still, they remain a scale of government and therefore are in a contradictory role, because on the one hand, they are closer to the problems of exclusion than higher up scales of government. Hence, they need to very pragmatically do something where such problems threaten the day-to-day reproduction of the city. And therefore, they do take up all the possibilities they have to find pragmatic solutions. And often that includes granting access to rights to those deprived of them. So this positioning of cities as the last instance or lowest instance of government implies on the one hand the potential that municipalities may provide, for example, people with unclear residence status with access to rights and services by exerting their relative autonomy vis-a-vis higher scales of government. In the case of migrant rights, local authorities may do so because they are usually more concerned with maintaining public order in their jurisdictions than they are with the legal status of their residents. And they also have particular urban capabilities to react autonomously to special conditions at the city level and to problems of everyday organization, as many in this field have pointed out. They have broad leeway or latitude in how they interpret and implement the respective laws that come from higher up places, and even in areas where higher levels of government prescribe in very detailed way the substance and the procedures of the tasks, and where municipalities aren't supposed to have any margins of discretion, even there, the frame set by national and state policies can often be stretched. So it is indeed the case that cities have become central agents in various fields, among them migrant rights, where they have built city networks, scaling up like Solidarity Cities Network and Cities of Safe Harbors, which you mentioned, and they have enabled infrastructures and policies to materialize innovative, effective, and even solidaristic solutions. But this policy area reveals at least two caveats, I think. They have been able to be protective or supportive only where strong civil society actors pressure them. So I think it should be super interesting to follow the initiatives you have selected in how they are able, through building intersectional strategies and through utilizing their networks, to continue to exert pressure, especially given the new circumstances. Because we are no longer in 2016, when many studies found that municipal leadership can indeed prioritize integration over regulatory and policing imperatives towards all refugees. The current trend points to a very different direction, with cities' resources more limited and with their strategies tending to differentiate more and more between more and less deserving refugees, in inverted commas, and especially the priorities now given to Ukrainian refugees. And the current trend, not only in Italy and in Denmark, but even other nations, of more and more authoritarian and repressive and xenophobic strategies, which populist movements demand and more parties are resorting to. So you may want to be more careful with your assumptions about the power of the urban scale. While a growing salience of cities as political actors and scales, especially vis-a-vis the national scale, is beyond a doubt, cities have also become less powerful with regard to private, particularly global actors such as investors, developers, banks, hedge funds, and so on and so forth.